Connor, welcome back to another season of We're Not All Like This, presented by, of course, Home Field Apparel. Usually this show focuses on college teams, college football teams, college basketball teams, college anything teams. We have stretched our wings in different ways previously, but this episode we're doing something brand new, and it probably is fitting that we're doing this in late May as the playoffs are reaching their peak. Today we're going to talk about the Chicago Bulls. I don't suppose you have any particular personal connections or memories of the Chicago Bulls by any chance, do you?
Let me prepare my written statement. Let me get this out of the way. Last year, someone on this podcast, it wasn't me, outed me for growing up for liking Notre Dame football. So I'll just get this out of the way. So I will out myself that I grew up a Chicago Bulls fan. Many of you are like, wow, Connor, isn't your whole entire brand and personality Indiana? And I will say, yes, it is. But here's my explanation. I was born in Chicago in 1994. And I feel like that's the only explanation that needs
to suffice.
That does
a lot. That does really sort of like laid out. Yeah.
And my parents lived in the city for 20 years. So I grew up initially with Chicago pro sports teams. If you notice, I still only cheer for Chicago pro sports teams, with the exception of the Indiana Pacers. Because I allowed myself to go through a wilderness for 10 years as an agnostic NBA fan, loving the game, because I'm from Indiana, of course, really. But I gave up on the Chicago Bulls when I became an adult. It probably also helped that Derrick Rose had torn his knee 3 times by then. And then I let myself be in the wilderness for 10 years. And then at some point I said, I've lived in Indiana for 20 years. I can embrace their NBA basketball team. So that is my statement. Thank you. I'm not ashamed of my past.
No questions.
Kirk Heinrich. No follow-ups. Kirk Heinrich is a legend. The Tyrus Thomas pick was brutal when it happened. Well, Luol Deng, you are a hero.
The Bulls have not gone to great efforts to retain you or other people who might have stuck with, like, if you don't live in Chicago and you're not like dyed in the wool all about it. Bulls are not working their asses off to sort of like bring in new people over the last, I don't know, 15 years.
Yeah, they have made some interesting moves, to say the least. They've tried to hover. They're the perennial play-in team now. They will never be better than that based off their decisions. They won't be worse than that. They have a really fun string of decisions, including my favorite was when they just were unashamedly selecting anyone and everyone having to do with Iowa State. They've taken 2 former Iowa State coaches in the last 2 decades between Tim Floyd and Fred Hoiberg, taking a bunch of Iowa State draft guys out of the draft. Just mind-numbing decisions based off of things that they liked Iowa State for a long time. So, you know, they haven't really done much outreach since, you know, having arguably the greatest player of all time dominate the league for 2 decades.
And this comes up on the episode, the Bulls are consistently, if not number one, top three when it comes to attendance. Like, people show up to Bulls games regularly. I think there are other times where you see former dynasties wane and sort of like the attention sort of drops off with them. But whatever reason, in Chicago, it's just like, no, we are going to be the highest attendance in the league, even if we're finishing below 500 consistently.
Yeah, the fans are dedicated. They're dialed in, man. After a while, I couldn't take it, and thus that's why I gave up when I turned 18 and relinquished all affection for them. But yeah. Even when they're putting together the world's most obvious 42-win team, those people still sell out the United Center. It's incredible, their dedication to a team that doesn't love them back.
So I'm going to ask you what may be a loaded question, given the teams that you root for. If you had to pick, if you sort of like were faced with the choice of you could have grown up, and you're a little young for this, so let's say it would have happened when you were like, I don't know, in late elementary school, in middle school, if you could grow up with that Bulls dynasty, those 6 titles, and then nothing for the rest of your life, it's like, maybe we'll make a run to the conference finals, but like, really, we're never going to touch that mountaintop again. Would that strike you as a fair trade? Would you be okay with that for one of your teams if they could have like this moment of being one of the most important and notable sports teams on the planet, but then they sort of were like, that was it. You didn't get – there was no resurgence later in life. Would you take that trade personally?
Absolutely. Six championships, right? Absolutely. As a kid, that's the hardest part about – I was born a little too late because I can barely remember. Like, I remember watching the 98 title in my parents' living room growing up. Like, yeah. I don't remember the game. I just remember celebrating. Yeah. And then my first Bulls experience was going to the United Center for the 1999 preseason, and that was depressing. But I think about it, I maybe cheer for a college team that's trying to chase a dragon of a lot of titles. And that happened all before me, too. So if I were able to experience those, chasing the dragon now would be a little different that I would be chasing an experience I had, not what people had told me. So similarly, like, yeah, it would suck to just, it does suck to be constantly trying to recreate something. But I think to a degree, honestly, all fandom, you're trying to recreate an experience you had when you fell in love with a certain team or game. At least not the entirety of fandom, but I think there's a strong portion of that I'm always trying to chase, like with the Cubs, like the 2001 season where Sammy Sosa hit 66 home runs, or that was 98, but when Sosa hit 61 home runs, I think, in 2001, mm-hmm. that's when I fell in love with the baseball.
Yeah.
The Cubs won the World Series. I still have fonder memories of that 01 season, right? So, like, I do think to a degree there's always something in fandom that, like, that critical moment of you growing up,
pulling back to nostalgia in some way.
Pulling back to nostalgia, right? Yeah, and so I would absolutely take the six titles that I could remember.
Yeah, I mean, I want all Florida football teams to have the vibe of a Steve Spurrier team.
Absolutely.
I just do. Like, it doesn't – like, I understand they've had good teams, bad teams since then, whatever. Like, they've won championships since then. And it's like, yep, but I always want the vibe to be a head ball coach wearing the visor – saying some smart alky shit after the game, no matter what. It has informed a lot of who I am, for better or worse.
That's what I mean. That's part of the magic of what we do with home field, though, too, is that we do different decades. But that's why when we do for Indiana football, because we're primarily college, right? You know, when we do the Oval logo, it's objectively ugly, but it's meaningful to a lot of people.
Sure.
Because, like, people like me, that was when I started watching Antoine Randall play football, and that is just seared in my brain, even though they never made a bowl and they were terrible with that logo, right? And it was ugly. So always just trying to call back to that specific time and recreate something in that vein.
Well, I don't know if the Bulls are going to get back. I don't know if the Bulls are trying to get back to that vein, truthfully, which is its own set of problems, but... The good news is we have three highly expert, highly Chicago guests who can walk us through the experience of being a Bulls fan and all the sort of like wrinkles that go with it as they watch the Pacers and the Knicks play for a spot in the NBA Finals.
My name is Ricky O'Donnell, and I am unfortunately a lifelong fan of the Chicago Bulls. It worked out pretty well during my childhood as I watched Michael Jordan win six championships for the franchise. Since then, a whole lot of mediocrity. I have spent most of my adult life chronicling the Bulls' addiction to mediocrity. I have a podcast on the Bulls called Cash Considerations, which we named after the Bulls. Selling some draft picks for cash at the start of a rebuild, usually not a smart move. And guess what? The rebuild continues like 10 years later for the Bulls without much progress. So I am someone who unfortunately watches most Bulls games and has since I can remember. And not much ever changes about this franchise.
I'm Maggie Hendricks. I'm Ryan's greatest enemy. But also, I want to talk about the Bulls because I've been a Bulls fan my entire life, and that has brought me great joy and great disappointment. So, yeah, I'm excited to talk about that. I also am a sports writer focusing on women's sports for Yahoo Sports. So check me out on, like, Blue Sky and Instagram and all that. But also be warned, on Instagram, you're also going to have to deal with my quilting and sewing and baking and stuff. So
I am Jack Silverstein, aka Reed Jack. I am Chicago's sports historian, and I am a sad Bulls fan.
Well, I want to start out on a positive note, and I want you to search through your memory and pick out the memory of rooting for the Bulls that brings you the most joy or is your happiest memory.
I was born in 1987, and one of the first things I can remember was John Paxson hitting the game-winning shot in the 1993 NBA Finals against the Phoenix Suns. My dad loved John Paxson. My dad is a Notre Dame fan. John Paxson went to Notre Dame, and Paxson was his guy. And I just remember him being so pumped when that happened. And the thing I remember about that game is that my dad, diehard sports fan, does not work in the industry because he's much smarter than me. But he gets very nervous when he watches the Bears, the Bulls, the White Sox. And in the 1993 NBA Finals and the NBA Finals when the Bulls were in them, he would leave the house and he would just like pace around Walgreens or Circuit City so that he did not have to watch these games. And then he would catch bits and pieces of the games on like the Circuit City TVs they were selling at the store. And then would come home. So I remember that he left. He came back. My mom was mad at him probably for leaving. And he like couldn't watch the game while I was locked in to the screen. But I just remember him screaming across the room, John Paxson hitting that shot. Bulls win the championship, you know, for the third straight time. They kept their first three-peat. And yeah, that's really the first, my first memory in life is Paxson splashing that shot to beat Phoenix.
June 20th, 1993. That is game six of the 1993 NBA Finals. Fandom is forged in doubt and being up against everybody. And it was a weird experience to feel like you knew for sure you had the best team in the world, but people were starting to pick against you. So we had won in 91, we had won in 92. 93, for a lot of reasons on that team, was a grind. Win total dropped by 10 from 67 to 57. MJ was having all the start, really, of all the gambling controversy. Scotty's numbers dipped a little bit. Horace's numbers dipped a little bit. Pax was battling injury. BJ played great, took over his starting spot, but Bill Cartwright was getting older. We had also let go of Craig Hodges and Cliff Levingston, who had been there 91, 92. Craig Hodges had been there back to 89. And so the team felt a little bit different. But I still was very certain that this was the best team in the NBA and we would win another championship. No one had won three in a row, though, since Russell's Celtics had won eight in a row. So I understood there was maybe some historical questioning, and we had finished number two in the East. We go to Phoenix, the, quote, team of destiny, and we do something that no one's ever done. We win the first two games of the finals on the road. No one had ever done that. The Rockets then did that to the Magic 2 years later when they swept them. But to that point, no one had ever done that. And then we lose the triple overtime game in Chicago. And it's like, eh. Then we win game four. MJ drops 54. And then we have the famous Suns, Charles Barkley save the city game, where because there had been, you know, riots and overturned cars and all that stuff, all the arrests after 91, 92. And Charles Barkley famously said, after the Suns won game five, they said, do you have anything to say to the fans in Chicago? And he said, take that shit off the windows. You won't need it now. So we go back to Phoenix. And now remember, in 2-3-2, now we're on the road for the final two games. And game six was just this beautiful game of basketball. I don't remember. I would have to look and see how big any of the lead changes were, but it was pretty close for most of the game. And you come down to the final minute and we're down 98-94. MJ comes down and gets a layup. we force Phoenix into a 24-second shot violation on an air ball, and then we come down and everyone touches the ball. So MJ inbounds to BJ, who kicks it back to Mike. MJ dribbles up toward half court, and then the Phoenix rotations were just a man slow from this point on at every step. So Mike gets to half court, the double comes, he passes it over to Scotty. Scotty catches it just past midcourt. Scotty drives in, the double comes, he kicks it down to Horace Grant, who had been having a bad shooting series. Horace catches it right under the basket, so a dunk ties the game. The double comes, he turns, fires it back out to Pax, who's wide open. Pax catches, shoots, he hits the three, 3.9 seconds remaining. Bulls now up 99-98, and Phoenix inbounds it. They get it back to KJ. KJ cuts in, and Horace Grant gets the block. So Horace Grant, having a bad series, gets the finals winning assist and finals winning block. John Paxson, having a tough year, gets the one of the most famous three-pointers, one of the most famous shots in NBA history. MJ was the only person to score in the fourth quarter for the Bulls until Paxson shot, and he had to give the ball up. 93 was the sheen came off, and now it was like, who's left? And that, as a fan, you always want to feel like you're left when everybody else departed. And Bulls fans didn't depart, but like, the national opinion had changed. And so June 20th, 1993, man, my favorite day in Bulls history.
You know, I was a teenager throughout the 90s, which means I was a teenager as the Bulls won their six championships. The first one, I think I was in seventh grade. And then the last one was my first year of college. So those were like hugely formative years to be a sports fan. And the Bulls were incredible. So, like, it made me love basketball. It made me love the NBA. And so I think the number one memory, actually, I have two from the championships. One, in 1992, my dad was a car salesman, and he sold Mercedes. And so he sold a lot of Mercedes to Bulls players, Bulls staff, and all of that kind of thing. So he got tickets for my birthday. Lucky enough to have a birthday in June, which is when all the championships would be. He got tickets to my birthday to go to one of the finals games. They didn't win. It was the second game against Portland. But it was still just like it. Also, this was the old Chicago Stadium. It wasn't United Center. So it was like so loud and so exciting. And in that they didn't win was a huge shock. But it was also just one of those moments of like, I got to be there to see some of the best players of all time, one of the best coaches of all time. And I was 13. And that just kind of set me on the path of absolutely loving basketball. And then in 1991, when they won the first one, it was my whole family sitting around in our living room. And when the time, you know, went out and they had won, like, we just all stood up and started yelling. Dogs started barking. Like, it was chaos, but it was the happiest chaos. And, like, as far as being a Chicago sports fan, my identity is much more wrapped up in the Cubs because my grandma was a huge Cubs fan. My grandfather on the other side was a huge Cubs fan. So, like, it is baked into me.
Yeah.
But that was so much failure. So, like, having a team that won and won it all, and we got to go to a rally in Grant Park, and it was all this excitement. That was a completely different kind of experience that I didn't even know I could have. And then I got to have it five more times. It was so cool. And I will always treasure it's wrapped up with me, those 90s Bulls teams, not just about that they were about, like, they were winning, but they were also, like, great times with my family watching them win.
Well, the other thing that sticks out to me that is, I think, different from other dynasties in sports is they were incredibly cool. Like, they weren't, it wasn't just like, oh, this is a dominant team. We've seen, like, you know, I'll throw out the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs had great runs under Greg Popovich and accomplished great things. But I don't think they ever, like, cracked the cultural egg in a way that was like, oh, this is the coolest team maybe in sports.
Yeah.
Was that sort of the feeling within Chicago of, like, not only are we watching this, like, once-in-a-lifetime team, it's also, like, it has this cultural impact where people who don't even care about sports that much know and have feelings about the team that we root for.
Oh, absolutely. Because then it also made us, by extension, made their fans, made us cool too. Mm-hmm. So, like, that was a part of it. And when I was growing up, my family hosted kids from Northern Ireland. That was like a, it was like a peace initiative kind of thing. That they make fun of in Dairy Girls, which I, you know, they made fun of it. But so when the kids would come from Northern Ireland, they would be like either 12 or 15. The main thing they wanted to talk about was the Bulls and Michael Jordan and all of that. And it, something you heard again and again from older Chicagoans during those runs was Chicago was no longer about Al Capone. It was now mm-hmm. about Michael Jordan.
Oh, wow. And
yeah. So it changed not just, it changed a lot of the world's perception on Chicago, which was a pretty cool thing, especially because the Chicago in the 90s was Chicago at its most dangerous. There were more homicides mm-hmm. than ever. So like that Chicago still maintained that coolness, even while there was a lot of bad stuff going on, like was pretty meaningful.
I'm working on a book, Six Rings, which will be the first comprehensive book on the dynasty. And you can follow all my work at readjack.substack.com. And as I say, it is for the low, low price of Pax in a month or Pip in a year. And if you get that, you'll like it. And if you don't get it, you know.
You'll figure it out. Yeah.
You'll figure it out. And then we also have a founding membership called The Breakfast Club for $87 because – in 1996, the Bulls won 87 games. We won 87-13 when you combine the regular season and the postseason. So I thought 87 was a good number.
Sure, yeah.
And a lot of what I write about is that cultural aspect that surrounded the team. And it was unprecedented. I think the Patriots are the greatest dynasty in the history of American sports because the degree of difficulty is – even more, I mean, it's off the charts. Culturally, there was nothing like it. So if you look at like the second three-peat, okay? MJ's got Space Jam. Dennis has Double Team with Van Damme. He's got Rodman's World Tour. Michael's got a shoe, obviously. Yeah. Scotty's got a shoe. Dennis has a shoe. The zip up, I bought those. They didn't work. You couldn't, I mean, they were like stylistic, but you couldn't hoop in them. Like you had to lace the laces through the circle of the zipper. There are obviously books about MJ, but I mean, Dennis became obviously a phenomenon culturally. I mean, he showed up at the Oscars with Vivica Fox. You know, obviously he shows up to sign his book and he did two famous book signings. One was in the BOA at Borders and then here. And then one obviously was the wedding dress.
Yeah.
Where he was going to get married. He announced, if people don't remember, so Dennis announced he was going to get married at his book signing. And the bride arrives and then she takes off the veil and it's Dennis.
Right.
That was the book signing. but like, let's go further down. Bill Wennington had a McDonald's signature sandwich.
way before that was a thing that like every celebrity could get.
Exactly. Exactly. Like the shirts and the movies and the TV shows and the, like you said, also just the merch. And that carries into right now because the Bulls have stayed as one of the top five NBA merch sales and top five jerseys and top five logos. It's the Bulls, man. It's the Bulls logo. Like it's one of the few, it's also one of the few logos that has sustained. I mean, the Bulls logo is original.
The first thing I would say is that growing up as a Bulls fan in the 90s, I never even considered the possibility that they wouldn't win the championship. It was just like, you have Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. Michael Jordan always wins the championship. And so that is going to happen. And honestly, that is what happened. Since he broke through in 1991 through his second retirement with the Bulls in 1998, I mean, 6-0 in the NBA Finals, baby. So it lived up to it, I would say. And I think just, you know, like the 90s, there was just like so much more monoculture than there is now. Like people could latch on to Jordan as this like worldwide phenomenon. And like, I've thought this about D Rose too, like sort of parsing the D Rose era where like, it felt like MJ belonged to the entire world. Mm-hmm. Like he wasn't just Chicago's, like, you know, the Bulls would go play preseason games in France and it would be like, you know, the Pope arriving basically. Like people would like worship the ground that Jordan was walking on. So it was just cool to have like this worldwide phenomenon be like based in Chicago and really like putting Chicago on the map in the 90s. And yeah, you just always felt like they could never lose with Jordan. And that's basically how it ended up playing out.
What is Garpax? What does it mean? And what is it sort of, what unpleasant memories does it evoke for you and most other Bulls fans?
Yeah, of course, John Paxson would later become the bane of my existence as an adult because he was the GM of the Bulls for, I don't even know the exact amount of time, something like the post-Jerry Krause era, let's say like 2003 through when we finally got him fired following, you know, the 2020 NBA All-Star game. The Bulls, they never, you know, it was always sort of tough to tell who was really in, who really had the power in the Bulls front office. As Paxson's time went on, as the GM, the lead executive, they hired another guy, Gar Foreman, who rose from a scout to, you know, their general manager. Paxson was always sort of above him, but then at a certain point, they sort of like switched roles, and then Foreman was taking on more of the player personnel decisions. So when it was like a two-headed, you know, front office, fans called him Gar Pax because we never really knew who had the final say on their decision making. And it would change, honestly, from season to season based on, you know, how much conviction Paxson had in his player personnel decisions at the time.
So it was Gar Foreman and John Paxson. Gar Foreman was the general manager, I believe, and John Paxson was like the vice president of basketball operations. And the John Paxson thing is so complicated because it's not even complicated. He just did a heel turn. John Paxson was on three of those teams that won championships in the 90s. He was the three-point guy. He was like the white guy who could hit from the outside. So, mm-hmm. And that's who he was. And then he went into operations and went into basketball operations, and the Bulls named him their vice president. By the way, B.J. Armstrong had been working the entire time in Bulls operations, and a lot of people thought he was going to get that job. And Chicago also really loves B.J. Armstrong. So John Paxson getting that job was already complicated. So when, and now B.J. went into being an agent and is making more money and is probably happier, but whatever. So then Gar Foreman and John Paxson were the minds that were at the head of the Bulls, and they made so many befuddling decisions that people still can't explain today. And like they fired coaches 10 games into the season. I think Fred Hoiberg, it was like 10, 15 games into the season. And they would get enamored with a college coach and then be like, I got to bring in this college coach. And of course, then the college coach would be like from Iowa State. Like it wouldn't be a great college coach. It would be a college coach who, like, I don't know, had dinner with John Paxson and paid the bill. But like there is no reason for John Paxson and Gar Foreman to get so excited. And the funny thing is, so Jerry Reinsdorf, this is true of him both for the Bulls and the White Sox because he owns both. He is very loyal, definitely loyal to a fault, that if somebody shows loyalty to him, he's not getting rid of them. He's just not. And so that's one of the reasons why the Gar Pax era went on for so long and had these weird things like, sure, let's sign Dwayne Wade. And you know what? Dwayne Wade being in Chicago was great for me because he kept doing all these community initiatives and I kept getting invited to go and cover them. And it was great. And I got to write a lot of things that I loved, and I liked Dwayne Wade a lot. He made no sense with the Bulls,
right?
Playing with Jimmy Butler and Rajon Rondo. Like, it made no sense from a basketball perspective. I loved him, having him here in Chicago, but it made no sense. So yeah, the Garpax era it was not like the Pax Romana. It was actually quite bad. It was quite bad.
All right. So on August 1st, 1998, the Bulls hired Gar Foreman. He was the Tim Floyd era. He was the post dynasty, pre anything else of relevance hire. John Paxson came in as the head of the Bulls and turned the ship around. And John Paxson built the first post dynasty playoff team. In the mid to late 2010s, Gar Pax started to kind of merge. It was like a face merge into like one, you know, organism. And we started calling him one thing, and it wasn't clear where one's authority ended and the others began. All that was clear was that suddenly we weren't challenging for championships anymore. We weren't really challenging for the East anymore. After that great 2015 run. So we fire Tibbs, we bring in Fred Hoiberg, and now you're adrift. 16, make the playoffs in 17 with the old guys, the three alphas, 18 miss, 19 miss, 2020, you're getting booed hosting the All-Star game. And then that was the end of Garpax. And now we're in a new one with AK, sort of like the new same problem.
Is there a Garpax decision that you look back on and say, that's emblematic of like what didn't work or what went wrong?
Oh, younger and more athletic. Younger and more athletic. And you go out and you get Rondo and D-Wade. Younger and more athletic. At least when Jerry said players alone don't win championships, organizations do. I mean, he had something to back that up. He had some jewelry. His name's in the rafters. Younger and more athletic.
Oh, yes. The Jimmy Butler trade would, of course, be the moment I'm thinking of. I remember we were doing an SB Nation live show for the 2017 NBA draft when this happened, and I had a complete meltdown live and on air as everyone watched at me and mocked me relentlessly. And our old friend Dan Rubenstein was hosting the show, and the Bulls had just drafted Lauri Markkanen at number 7 overall. And he goes, Ricky, do you feel better now that the Bulls have drafted Lauri Markkanen? And I just started screaming, no, I feel worse. And, you know, Lauri Markkanen turned into a pretty good NBA player. He signed a very large contract with the Utah Jazz last year. He, of course, didn't do too much for the Bulls and really grew into the best version of himself as soon as he left Chicago, like so many other players. The Bulls also got Zach LaVine in that deal. They got Chris Dunn in that deal. All those guys still around and kicking. Chris Dunn was playing real minutes for the Los Angeles Clippers this year. They were a pretty good playoff team. Zach LaVine can score a lot of points pretty efficiently. Makes a lot of money and nobody wanted to trade for him, but the Bulls were finally able to get rid of his albatross contract this year. But Zach LaVine, pretty good player. So I think, like, you know, you could look at the pieces of that deal and think, well, hey, maybe Garpax did pretty good in this trade. They traded Jimmy Butler. They got three guys who are younger, you know, still around to this day, but they have never had someone on the team as good as Jimmy Butler from the moment they traded him. And they traded him because they did not want to pay him. They did not think that he would be able to still be performing like a max player over the next 4 years when they traded him. Well, we are coming close to the 10-year anniversary of the Bulls trading Jimmy Butler's ability to perform as a max player. And he's basically still doing it. I mean, just in the 2025 playoffs without Steph Curry, in, I believe it was game 3 of their first round series against the Houston Rockets, I think Butler had like 35 points, basically put the team on his back. And he's, of course, now kind of in the twilight of his prime, I would say, if not the twilight of his career. But still just an incredible player. And really, as soon as the Warriors traded for him this season, he essentially saved their year and just gave them real hope until Stephen Curry suffered a series-ending injury and a season-ending injury against the Rockets. So that was really the moment when I felt like for like the skill that Paxson did have at one point as an executive to build some decent teams for a while, that's when the game had just totally passed him by. And I would also point to the hiring of Jim Boylan, who was sort of the head coach in the wake of the Jimmy Butler trade, who was just a babbling mess of a man, led to Paxson firing himself, you know, at the end of his tenure.
When the Bulls are bad or when the Bulls are struggling, does the city feel different or react differently compared to the baseball teams, the Bears, any other team in the city? Like, is there something different about Bulls' struggle that affects the city, or is it kind of the same no matter which team we're talking about?
It's not the same because the Bears are on a different level than all the other Chicago teams. Even while the Bulls were winning, that's no matter what. And the Bears were terrible in the 90s. But no matter what, the Bears are always number one in Chicago. So, like, when the Bears are doing bad and you expected them to do well, that really affects the entire mood of the city. I have good friends who work for the Chicago Tribune, and I'll tell you, and also when I worked for the radio station, for the sports talk station, people always want to talk about the Bears, no matter what. The Bulls, it's much more like based on what our expectations were, are from the team. So like the Joakim Noah, Derrick Rose teams, when they started winning, it was like, oh, we should have expectations. Okay, so now we're going to get excited about them. And so when that happened, then Chicago's mood was a lot more based on that, on the Bulls teams. But since then, there was the Jimmy Butler era and the Dwayne Wade, Rajon Rondo year and like all of those things. They just keep teasing Bulls fans. And then the last, what, 5-6 years, they've just been in this purgatory of middling and being excited about making the play-in tournament that now I don't think it hits the same kind of zeitgeist, especially this past year with a lot of people, not including me, not being able to watch them through most means. I'm catching most of the Bulls on, you know, clips on social media. So it's a weird thing that the way the expectations kind of define then how people react to it.
Pretty much falls into a very similar pattern. When the Bulls got good, everyone was a Bulls fan. When the Hawks started winning cups with Kaner and Taves and Sieves and Dunk Keith and all those guys, everybody was a Hawks fan. There was that great clip from Marcus Lee Schock. Shout out to Marcus at WGN. After the Hawks won in 2015, and he was doing interviews late night, is dark, man on the street interviews, and he's got the camera rolling, and he sees a guy walking up with a Hawks shirt, black guy, and he says, "Excuse me, sir, like, can we speak to you? You're on." He's wearing a Hawks shirt. He goes, "We're on WGN," and he goes, "Like, how do you feel? Or how great are the Hawks?" It was some very leading, like, prompt question just to get sound, and the guy goes, "You know how good the Hawks are? This is going to sound messed up. They got black people loving hockey. Isn't that something?" And he walked off. Oh, it shut it down. Oh, the laughs. That clip makes me laugh every time. And that was really emblematic of how the Hawks had taken over the city. And the Bulls had done the same thing a decade earlier. But when those teams are bad, you really only have like specific Bulls fans or specific Hawks fans dealing with it. When the Cubs are bad, it's the Cubs fans, obviously, who care. The White Sox fans don't care. The only team that really has everybody is the Bears.
When the Bears are bad, it's like a huge civic problem. Like, okay. Everyone in the city is like pissed off all the time about the Bears being bad. It's like a 5-alarm fire during the John Fox era, during Mark Trestman's time as the head coach for the Bears. It's a big issue. The Bulls, you know, as I've said, they do less with more than any other franchise. I think that it's just business as usual with the Bulls right now. Like, they don't actually try to win. And that has just never changed about the franchise. They've just kind of been in this middle ground where they know that they can make money, not trying that hard. They know they can sell out the arena every time. Occasionally, I'll go to look to, you know, attend a Bulls game during a weekend, Friday, Saturday, look up tickets. You're still paying like $100 to get into the stadium, basically, because there's just a huge appetite for the Bulls. And I now view going to a Bulls game as like going to a Saved by the Bell themed bar. It's not like something where you're going to for the experience today. It's like, hey, remember when this was cool? Remember when we were young and didn't have to worry about saving for retirement, and they played the Alan Parsons Project during the starting lineup, and everyone was happy and there was no anxieties in your life? That is like what it's going to a Bulls game now feels like. I think it's like stepping in a time machine to a bygone era, and it shouldn't have to be that way. The Bulls, they could try to build a good team if they wanted to, but they just don't have much interest in doing it. And you know, they did fire Garpax eventually. I was very hopeful when that happened. I was naive. I was young. I was stupid. I thought maybe this can change. But as long as Jerry Reinsdorf is still walking this mortal coil, I would say there is no hope for the Chicago Bulls, the Chicago White Sox, and even extended to the Bears, who are not technically owned by Jerry Reinsdorf, but spiritually, they've always felt like they're owned by Reinsdorf.
Oh, so much of, I think, what the Bulls have been or failed to be in the last, 20 plus years really has to do, 30 years, I guess, really has to do with the Jordan Pippen teams and how good they were and how cool they were, really, in a lot of respects as well. Is that what Bulls fans need the team to get back to? Do they need to have a, like, dominant in a basketball sense and in a cultural sense team? Or is there something below that, like, if the Bulls could achieve X, that would get fans back on board, and that would feel like, okay, fans can feel a certain level of satisfaction, maybe, even if it's just a temporary one? Like, where does this team need to go to sort of give the fans what they deserve at this point?
Sure, I don't think that the fans are asking for a dynasty. I don't think dynasties are really going to exist in this current era of the NBA. I say this in the Oklahoma City Thunder or the Spurs with Wemby could roll one off, but we're about to have 7 different champions in 7 years. Never happened in NBA history before. So certainly I don't think anyone's asking for a dynasty. What they would like to see is a team that actually tries to win, and a team that can sort of leverage its cultural cachet to be a nationally relevant franchise. The Bulls are so deeply irrelevant on the national NBA scene, and truly nobody does less with more than the Bulls do. And I have just one of my things as a Chicago sports fan is that the Bears are the only Chicago sports team that actually tries to win, and they're too stupid to achieve it over the course of the last 30 years. But the Bears will try. They'll make a move for, you know, 2 first round picks for Jay Cutler and Khalil Mack.
Yeah.
They will sign Julius Peppers. They'll do some cool stuff, and it'll blow up in their face because they have horrible coaching and terrible QBs, but they will make an attempt to try to win. You know, what a Jerry Reinsdorf team truly does, as someone who is both a Bulls and a White Sox fan, is that they will put in the bare minimum amount of effort, set very low expectations for themselves, and still fall short. And I have this old quote pulled up. Jerry Reinsdorf apparently said this to David Sampson, who is a former Marlins executive. I think he's on the Lebatard show now.
Yeah.
Sampson told this story where he said, Jerry told him, quote, "Finish second every single year because your fans will say, wow, we got a shot. We're in it. But there's always the carrot left." And to me, this just personifies the Jerry Reinsdorf experience more than anything else. He wants to win, quote unquote, but only on his terms. And that goes to, you know, his union busting back during the 1994 baseball strike. And it goes to how he's operated the Bulls and the White Sox, you know, over the last 30 years. A common line for both the Bulls and the White Sox is the complete lack of investment in the infrastructure of the team. Mm-hmm. The Bulls currently, I think, have one analytics guy on staff, while most of their competitors have entire departments of people who are trying to use data to make informed decisions on how to build the team. It's one of the sneaky ways in that Reinsdorf is very cheap. So you could say, like, oh, the Bulls have only paid the luxury tax one time in its existence, and it was by mistake because they couldn't get rid of guys they thought they could get rid of. And that is an obvious example of Reinsdorf being very frugal. But also, he just doesn't invest in anything or anyone around these organizations when he doesn't have to. And when you talk to people who have worked with Reinsdorf, he sounds like an amazing boss. You have a job for life when you get a job from Jerry Reinsdorf. He doesn't expect you to do too much. Just don't bother him. Don't embarrass him.
I mean, that's a big part of the Garpax era, is sort of like, how are these guys sticking around and continually taking this team in circles?
Absolutely. And, you know, we're not there yet, but somehow they replaced him with a guy who's even worse than John Paxson and Gar Forman, and that would be the Bulls' current GM, Arturas Karnišovas. But, you know, just the Bulls, they should be, you would think, with a global fan base, with the biggest arena in the NBA that sells out every single game. The Bulls are consistently leading the league in attendance, even if they have a bad team. Chicago is the biggest market in the country that only has one NBA team. LA and New York both have two teams. And the Bulls have it all to themselves, and they don't really have to do much to have the cash cow be paying off year after year after year. And I think that they've just grown fat and lazy with that, and have really just settled into a nice long road of not trying that hard and of being as mediocre as they can be.
I mean, Bulls fans aren't like, say, like Nebraska football fans, so that they're like, why aren't we winning championships right now? Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. like, well, just take a look around. I think the Bulls or Bulls fans just want to see a plan and some sort of movement, whether that's tanking and trying to get that top pick, or that's actually really going out and trying to get free agents and making a real push to show. But the thing that a lot of Bulls fans are frustrated with is we're the number three market in the country. This is a wonderful place to be in the summer. This is a desirable place to be. What is the disconnect between front offices, the front office, and the free agents? Because it started with LeBron James when he first did his I'm taking my talents to South Beach.
Yep.
Like, there was a lot. I think he did a visit in Chicago. And there was a lot of optimism in Chicago. And I think from that day on, every Bulls fan has been like, okay, fine, we didn't get LeBron, but what are we doing wrong here that the hottest free agents don't want to come to Chicago? Because they haven't been able to sign anybody. And we know money isn't the issue anymore because all the contracts are about the same. So what the heck is it, you know?
Yeah, one thing at a time. I mean, win a championship. If the Bulls had won with Derek and Joe, that would have been enough.
While the Bulls have been mired in, let's say, bad to mediocre, who is the East team that they hate seeing succeed? Like, who is the Eastern Conference team that they're like, if they win a title before we win another one, that's just going to sting? Is there one that sticks out as like, look, we want to be good. We really want them to not be good.
I think it depends. It depends maybe somewhat on your age. I think that younger Bulls fans look at, like, Cleveland was just really bad and they won 64 games this year. And yeah, they had that loss in the second round, but like Cleveland was really bad and they've turned it around. You know, I think probably they look a little bit more at that. Look, it's hard to have rivalries when you're bad. My kids are young and they like basketball, and they're more into the Sky because at least the Sky won a title when they were around. But I had to explain, like, I kind of like this Knicks team. I like watching them. I just like the way they play. I don't have any like specific beef with any of the players. Now it's the Knicks, so I have a problem there. But, you know, Knicks fans are also, look, the Knicks haven't won a championship since 73. I understand heartbreak and determination and paying your penance, and I understand all that. So I have a soft spot for any
frustration with an owner you think is not living up to expectations.
So I have an understanding there for them. And the Pacers too. The Pacers won 3 ABA titles. Their last title was the same year as the Knicks' last title, 73. Knicks and the Pacers last went to a finals a year apart, 99 for New York, 2000 for Indiana. So I get that, but we were watching the Knicks Pacers last night. And my kids were like, let's go Knicks. And I was like, all right, let's settle it down. Let me explain something. I just said I kind of liked watching the Knicks. My kids are like real fans, but they're like homeless fans. Like they have to walk into every game that I'm watching and they're like, who are we rooting for here?
Right.
And I'm like, well, nobody really, because our team was eliminated 3 months ago. But and pick a sport. It's true.
Yeah.
So I had to say, I was like, well, hold on. Like the Knicks and Pacers are rivals with the Bulls. And my daughter, who's about to turn 8, was like, what? I said, yeah. She goes, but we like the Bulls. I was like, I know. It's a big, big problem.
The easy answer here is the Knicks. But I don't really think that counts anymore because of Tom Thibodeau. And mm-hmm. Thibodeau was really the Bulls' only good coach post Phil Jackson. Scott Skiles had his moments, but he could never really like get the team over the hump, but Thibodeau was great for a while. And Thibodeau sort of wore out his welcome here because he thought Garpacks were huge idiots. And he was right. We all agreed with him. But your bosses don't like that when you just openly say that they are incompetent fools. And it led to a lot of paranoia within the front office. There were reports when that was happening that like the front office was bugging his office to try to like, you know, just get any dirt on him that they could. It was all very silly and juvenile and immature, but that is the Chicago Bulls experience in a nutshell. So I wouldn't really say that there is a true rival for the Bulls. You know, the Knicks make sense from the 90s, but at this point it's like, dude, the Bulls are competing with the Atlanta Hawks in the play-in tournament every year. They're going against the Toronto Raptors in the 9-10 game. Nobody really cares, and the checks are still clearing. So at this point, I would say there are no true rivals.
Oh, yeah, it's the Knicks. But you know what the funny thing is? It's probably the two of the teams I hated the most through the Bulls championship run were the Pacers and the Knicks. Sure. Because Reggie Miller was mean.
Yeah.
And I am just hardwired to hate the Knicks. Like there's no, mm-hmm. And the funny thing is I like this Knicks team. I like Tibbs. I didn't think he got a fair shake in Chicago. I like Jalen Brunson's from Chicago. Like there's a lot of guys I like on this Knicks team and it drives me insane because I'm like, no, I hate you. But yeah, I don't want the Knicks to win. I want the Bulls to win like 10 more titles before the Knicks can break that streak from like 1972.
From the 70s or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, let's be clear. The New York Liberty existed and like had their entire existence and won a championship in like half of the time of that Knicks streak. But man, and so like I can always make fun of that, but also they have a good, fun team right now. And oh,
yeah.
So annoying.
Yeah. We've talked about a lot of different players from a lot of different eras of Bulls history. Many of them like some of the most famous players in the league, some of the most like entertaining or talked about players in the league. But I want to sort of like swing the other direction. Is there one player you can think of who maybe wasn't as nationally heralded, who Chicago fans really took to, who they really developed a relationship for, like, this is our guy and we really love him on this team?
I'd say first probably Norm Van Leer would probably be the first one, and Jerry Sloan, those two guys, and having that gritty defensive minded backcourt. Sloan coached the team. He He was the first Bull. He was the first retired number. They should have retired Norm's number right after it. The fact that they didn't and he passed away, you're never getting that one back. You know, in the title years, you kind of ended up loving everybody. Like and guys were around for a long time. Judd Bushler was a huge fan favorite. Randy Brown also was from here. So he was another one. But and then if you go into the years afterwards, so after when you don't have a championship to fall back on, I don't know how much national love did Heinrich get. Like Heinrich was a pretty big deal here. And but I don't think anyone has hit and Derek having been from here and then being the MVP, but I guess the person who stands out as someone who came here and won over the city in a huge way and became someone who it almost felt like he's from here, but he's not. And he didn't have a championship. And it's one of those, like, we wanted to win a title for him. And I think that's true for Lou Wall, who we've mentioned. But Joakim Noah. I think Joakim Noah is probably the guy who, and he did have a level of national love, especially because he had such a high profile at Florida. But Joakim Noah, he played the way that Chicagoans like really love and value. Obviously, he had the steal and then the breakaway dunk in Game 6 against the Celtics. That was a huge deal. Then the fact that he took the mantle of the team over after Derek's injury, the offense started running through him at the top of the key, the way that then Golden State started doing with Draymond and other teams start doing now. I don't want to say that started with Joe, but he was an early adapter of that. And then, you know, won Defensive Player of the Year and first team all NBA. And even at center, when there are fewer great centers, I mean, I don't care. Like, it's still a huge deal. And Joe did that. But then the work that he's done actually in the city and building community and working with St. Sabina, Joakim has just been someone who came here and stayed here.
Horace Grant's a big one. We love Horace Grant. And Horace Grant has done like a bunch of TV work in Chicago since. Luke Longley will always be, even though he's like back in Australia and he's not here, we will always love Luke Longley. And Taj Gibson from the more recent ones.
Yeah.
And like, he just was such a hardworking. He was, you know, lunch pail guy. And Chicagoans love to act like that's who we are. I don't know if we are or not, but like he just works his butt off. And so like, and anytime he has come back and played in Chicago, even he's all the way at the end of the bench.
Yeah.
They cheer, they chant for Taj to get to play in the game every single time. And they always do it. Tibbs always is like, yeah, of course you can come in the game, and the fans go nuts.
Yeah, well, we got one in common on this one. I'm going to say it's Joakim Noah, who, when they drafted him, this is the start of my blogging career. I wrote some blogs. Who should the Bulls draft? Spencer Hawes out of Washington or Joakim Noah out of Florida? And, of course, Noah was widely reviled by a national audience coming out of college. Back-to-back national championships. And when he came to the Bulls, I think he was suspended his rookie year by his teammates for like basically showing up late to practice, not being like a serious professional basketball player. But I think Chicago loves an instigator. And that was the case with Dennis Rodman. It was the case with a guy named AJ Pierzynski, who was a catcher for the White Sox. Someone who, you hate him when he's on the other team, but you love him when he's your guy. And Noah really personified that, and I think lived it. And he just became sort of like the face of the team after Rose went down with the ACL injury. With Thibodeau as the head coach, every game is treated like a game seven. Every game is, you know, we're playing the starters 50 minutes in Orlando.
We're mashing the gas pedal as hard as we can. Yeah, right.
Exactly, yeah. Every game's a game seven. That's the mentality of a Thibodeau team. And Noah was at the center of that. And, you know, it's not lost on me that we get to still watch his college teammate Al Horford competing in 2025, while Noah's heyday has been, you know, so far removed at this point. Like, he did play in the bubble a little bit for the Clippers, but like, he's been basically out of the NBA spotlight for a long, long time at this point. Perhaps because Thibodeau played him until, you know, his bones were turned into dust. But Noah gave it his all every single moment he was on the floor. I'll never forget the Bulls' last game 7, 2013, in Brooklyn against the Nets. The Bulls, they hate me, so they never credential me for a game. But they did credential me for the last regular season game of the 2013 season. I don't remember what I was working on at the time, but the thing I remember from being in there is that Noah's feet were in just ice buckets after the game, and he had plantar fasciitis. His feet were just torn to shreds. I mean, the guy was just visibly in excruciating pain after the last game of the regular season. And he went out there against the Nets in the first round of the playoffs. There was no D. Rose. His best teammate was probably Nate Robinson, who had one or two iconic performances in that series. But Noah was just incredible on both ends of the floor. He was the Bulls' lead playmaker as a center. He would facilitate the offense from the high post. He was Defensive Player of the Year, top five in MVP voting that season too, I believe. And he just willed them to a victory in Brooklyn in Game 7. And that isn't the Bulls' most recent playoff series win, but it's their second most recent playoff series win. They also won one series in 2015. Then they fired Thibodeau, and they have not won a series since. But I think everyone loved Noah. And then, you know, Noah, too, he would do so much work in the community, mm-hmm. in the city. Like, he started a lot of, like, anti-gun violence initiatives, and he would just be, like, out in the city promoting, you know, just like a safer city and safer schools for Chicago. So I think that he really won over Chicago's heart during his time as a Bull.
Let's imagine a spectrum and hopefuls on one end and miserables on the other. Where do Bulls fans at this point in time fall in there?
So the sad thing is that they fall straight in the middle. And I think that's actually the most dangerous place for them to be, because miserable is still passion. Anger is still passion. But Bulls fans are becoming so apathetic and disconnected to the team. And a not a small part is the TV thing. So it's hard to, like, get excited. And so once you start feeling apathetic, that apathy just grows. And it's a lot harder to want to watch a game, to get excited, to pay money to go, to leave your house on a December night to go to the United Center when your house is warm, you know, all of these things, it's a lot harder. So it's just, they're right in the middle, and it's just straight apathy.
Pissed. I think you can be hopeful and pissed. And I think pissed is, that's the emotion. That's where people are, because it's the feeling of, of AK saying again that, you know, we're happy with where we are. We're excited to make we like our group, and like, we're excited to make this run to the playoffs, to get to the, like, every one of his quotes is like, dude, just kill me now. Like, this is why I have kids who are like, when are the Knicks on? I'm like, guys, you know, that's what you're doing to people. So I would say people are probably more hopeless than hopeful, because that's how the last 10 years have been. But I think it's really positive and pissed.
Miserable. And it's one thing I deeply respect about Bulls fans in general. I compare it to Celtics fans. I feel like there's so many Celtics fans in the media, Celtics fans all over. And there's always a sense that, oh, you know, whatever the Celtics do, it's the right move. It's going to work out. You know, you have to trust the organization. Bulls fans are just completely the opposite way. It's like, well, if we did this, it's going to suck, and we're not going to be any good, and nothing good will ever happen to this franchise. So there's just like a cynicism and a level of skepticism with everything the Bulls do that is just, it's never going to be good enough for the team, for the fan base. And part of that is because, you know, they haven't won a playoff series in 10 years now. They fired Garpax and they hired someone who's legitimately worse. I never thought I would see it, but their current executive, Arturis Karnišovas, I mean, this guy is completely hopeless. So delusional. It's just every other GM of his caliber this offseason got fired. The Reinsdorfs aren't going to fire anyone. You get hired by a Reinsdorf, you got a job for life. You know, the Bulls, they're selling out every game. They're making money. The business is a success. It doesn't matter if the basketball team wins 39 games every year, regardless of what the roster looks like, despite being the biggest market team or one of the biggest market teams in the JV conference that is the East. So I would say that there is not much hope for the Bulls. Really, the only thing that could save them is some lottery luck. The same way they once got Derrick Rose. They had a 1.8% chance again this year in the lottery to get the number one pick. I'm of the belief you could not screw up Cooper Flagg. He is team proof. He could go to the worst franchise in the league and he would still perform at an all-NBA level, a fantastic prospect. The Bulls had a coin flip entering that lottery with the Dallas Mavericks. The Bulls lost the coin flip. The Mavericks picked 11, the Bulls picked 12. Well, that 11th pick ended up moving to number one in the lottery. The Bulls right back where they belong at number 12, you know, just outside of the playoffs, but still a small carrot of hope through the lottery. And, you know, the Bulls once lost a coin flip for Magic Johnson in 1979. That ended up working out okay for them because they got MJ. And then they lost a coin flip for the pick that ended up being the number two pick in 2018. The Sacramento Kings got that. It should have been the rights to Luka Doncic. Of course, the Sacramento Kings, just as hopeless as the Bulls, drafted Marvin Bagley the third with that pick. But you know, when the Mavericks really jumped up and it started coming out here, like, oh, the Bulls lost a coin flip for this pick. This could have been the Bulls' pick. It was just such a feeling of resignation and that nothing will ever change with this franchise, unless and until they suffer another stroke of luck that could somehow get them out of this run of mediocrity they've been so deeply embedded in since the MJ era.
Let me ask you one more follow-up. I lied. If that's true, and if for the foreseeable future, there is no hope and only mediocrity is on the horizon, are you okay with that given what came before it? Like, are you okay with that trade being like, yeah, I got to watch one of the greatest sports dynasties of all time and I got to like have that experience at a meaningful age? Like, are you okay with that trade if that's what it ends up being?
Kind of. Yeah, I kind of am. I mean, you can never take that away from the Bulls. And I feel like you get to relive it almost every summer, every offseason. I'll pick up a new book written during the Jordan era, or, you know, you'll watch The Last Dance or something else.
Yep.
And it's just like a cultural artifact that'll just never die. I feel the same way as a White Sox fan. The White Sox won the 2005 World Series championship. Nobody remembers this. It is often forgotten, even on ESPN, when they're listing the teams that won the championship. They just like, Red Sox 2004, and then nobody really knows what happened after that. But I was 18. I lived that. I experienced it. And I never really need the White Sox to win another championship. I do feel the same way about the Bulls in a sense. But I also feel like it is my duty and perhaps my life's work to tell the Bulls that they suck at every opportunity, because somebody has to. They think that, you know, because they make so much money, they sell out every game, that fans are going to the Saved by the Bell diner as much as they can, that they think this thing's a success, but it's not a success. They're huge losers and they're idiots. And somebody has to tell them that they are. So I'm not asking for six more championships. They could get to the conference finals once. Maybe that would be cool. But yeah, I do feel like you can't ask for too much more as a Bulls fan if you lived through the 90s, because you experienced one of the coolest dynasties of all time.
Many thanks to Maggie, Ricky, and Jack for joining me on this episode of We're Not All Like This. And as always, to our talented producer, Michael Serber, for putting this show together. If you'd like to listen to any of the other 41 episodes of We're Not All Like This, well, they're all still up and available on our original podcast feed, and they, like this one, are all presented by the fine folks at Homefield Apparel. New episodes are going to live here on the Phantom Island feed because, you know, we kind of just want to keep things pretty simple. Last but not least, thanks to you for listening. Please tell your friends, your coworkers, your family members about this show and the whole Phantom Island set. Give us a review on whatever podcast player you're listening to, or just post something positive at Godfrey on social media. He's not used to friendly feedback. It'll confuse him. It'll be fun.